Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Klass as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
What's up, this your boy Lil Duval, and check out my podcast, Conversations with Unc, on the Black Effect Podcast Network. Each and every Tuesday, Conversations with Unc podcast feature casuals and in-depth talk about ebbs and flows of life and the pursuit of happiness. Unlike my work on stage, I tap into a more serious and sensitive side to give life advice and simply offer words of encouragement, yet remind folks to never forget to laugh. Every Tuesday, listen to Conversations with Unc, hosted by Lil Duval on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Presented by AT&T. Connecting changes everything.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Welcome to Season 9 of Next Question with me, Katie Couric. I've got some big news to share with you in our season premiere featuring the one and only Kris Jenner.
Oh my gosh, congratulations. That is very, very exciting.
And that's just the beginning. We'll also be joined by podcast host Jay Shetty, Hillary Clinton, Renee Fleming, Liz Cheney, and many more. So come on in, take a break from the incessant negativity for a weekly dose of fascinating conversations. Some of them, I promise, will actually put you in a good mood. Listen to Next Question with me, Katie Couric, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind, a production of iHeartRadio.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Joe McCormick, and we're back again, catching up on listener mail. It's been a while. So this is the second of our recent dives into the long gathering mailbag.
That's right. And, you know, unfortunately, Carney, our mailbot, listened to our discussion of deja vu and has now updated his system to incorporate deja vu simulations. So we're having a lot of trouble here because he keeps pulling up emails, mail from listeners that he thinks that we have read before. So we have to get them back out of his trash, reevaluate them. It's really touch and go.
Yeah, there is no bigger hassle than a robot in a time loop. Got to keep that arrow of time with him.
That's right. But I don't know. I think maybe he's doing well enough to get us through one more listener mail here, and then we'll start, you know, running some corrective protocols on him.
Right. Diagnostics time, Carney. It's coming. All right. Well, maybe we should first take a look at this email we got from Ming. Now, this was in response to our episode MIB or NIB. I think this was – did we feature this from the vault recently? I think we did.
I believe we did, yeah.
Yeah. So this episode concerned similarities underlying traditional paranormal experiences that people attribute to supernatural forces like the devil, and then, you know, mid to late 20th century experiences of the so-called men in black, or what could be the, you know, what could be the common underlying psychology and stuff like that with those two types of experiences. So essentially, we're talking about the ways that UFO beliefs might spring from the same wells as more traditional religious or supernatural beliefs. And toward the end of the episode, I think I wondered out loud if there was any modern folklore in Chinese culture similar to the alien abduction and men in black complex in American culture. I couldn't find any evidence of that, but I asked listeners if they knew of anything like that. And so in response, we got this great message from Ming. So Ming says, "Hi again, Robert and Joe. Hope you're both doing well and staying safe inside during this crazy time. Your playlists have been powering me through my work from home days here in Toronto. I wanted to write in after listening to the MIB or NIB episode again, as your conversation about aliens, MIB, and what it'd be like in other cultures reminded me of a few fun thoughts. I'm not an ancient aliens person, but I do like to speculate in the name of science fiction and lore. Growing up Chinese, I've also fed off of legends and myths of Asia. There's an idiom in Chinese that literally translates to, heavenly clothes have no seams, but figuratively describes things that are perfect, flawless, and, you know, seamless. The story behind the idiom was written during the Five Dynasties and relates that a poet napping outside one night saw a heavenly figure descending from the skies. She was beautiful and her clothes were glowing. She introduced herself as the Weaver Girl from the myth of the cowherd and the Weaver Girl, and he noticed that her clothes had no seams. When he asked about it, she simply answered that clothes in heaven are made perfectly, do not require stitching, and therefore have no seams. Going off of the aliens idea, it's fun to imagine if she had been an alien and was wearing some kind of seamless bodysuit that aliens are often kitted out with in movies. To further link it to aliens and space, the Weaver Girl is the Chinese name for the star Vega, the cowherd is in Altair, which makes me wonder if she'd meant she was from Vega instead of actually being Vega or the Weaver Girl. Oh, like she was from Vega, which is great because Vega is where the alien radio signal comes from in Carl Sagan's Contact.
Huh.
But back to Ming's message, there's also another piece of lore about Chinese legends that loosely relates to the theory of relativity. A day in the heavens, a year on Earth. Protagonists of stories who were mortal or earthly to start with often find out too late that once they ascend to the heavens, a single day up in the sky means a year has passed down on Earth. So the mortal family they once had were all but gone by the time they've managed to finish the task they needed to do up in the heavens. I've read some discussion in Chinese about this. Some people think that the concept came about because ancient people understood that time passes differently depending on perception, but a great many who are into sci-fi, or the ancient alien truthers, believe this is possible proof that an ancient people understood the theory of relativity because someone somewhere had experience with space travel. Anyway, these stories have some very loose ties to things you spoke about in the episode, beings descended from the heavens or space, ancient aliens, sleep-related phenomena. So thank you both for reminding me of these interesting, if stray, thoughts. Thank you also for pulling in threads from other cultures while discussing many of your topics. It may seem a small act for you, but it really enriches the podcast experience for people of other cultures. Keep doing what you do, and much love from Toronto, Ming.
Awesome. Well, that was a wonderful listener mail. You know, obviously, we love to hear about you know, multicultural examples of some of the topics we've discussed. And yeah, this one was a real treat because I guess for me, when I'm hearing this, it reminds me a lot of what I'm pretty sure we discussed in that particular episode. The idea that like an incubus or a succubus in various European traditions would have like a telltale flaw. Like a goat feed or duck feed or something like that, that would allow an individual to realize they were dealing with something that is not quite human. And in a way, this is a version of that, right? Instead of a flaw, it is perfection. And like too much perfection is a kind of a flaw in any sort of design that is allowing an inhuman entity to pass as human.
Yeah. And I also really like this idea of ancient approximations of relativity. Now, obviously, I don't think it's very likely that ancient Chinese people had experience with aliens or space travel. But I do think that relativity is one of those interesting things where you can intuit a kind of general version of the theory just from subjective experience of life. Right. Like you don't actually know that, you know, that mass or velocity alters space-time, you know, or makes you know, extends or contracts space-time, but you do at least know that time doesn't always feel like it flows at the same rate. great.
Yeah, you would have some idea that that toiling in the soil seems to take all day, whereas just an hour of pleasure seems to pass by in a moment. So it seems reasonable that there would be the basic human experience of relativity that they would be able to draw on, and then work into some sort of a mythological structure.
But I do also like this idea how there are myths of people going up into the heavens and then experiencing this time dilation. It reminds me of like the scene in Interstellar where they have to go down to the planet that's very close to the black hole. And, for them, they're down there for like 20 minutes or whatever. But they come back to their friend and colleague up in the space station that's been orbiting it. And for him, it's been 20 years.
Yeah. All right. Well, let's pull up another bit of listener mail here. This one comes to us from Jonathan. Jonathan writes, "This moment in time is one of those where we, and hopefully you too, are reaping what you've been sowing for years." Well, that's a strange statement to make. I don't know. That sounds either hopeful or potentially ominous.
I think he's being very nice, but yeah, that statement in isolation sounds like a threat.
"Over many years," he continues, "I and a huge number of other listeners have grown to trust Stuff to Blow Your Mind to the extent that when you do an episode on COVID-19, that we can depend not only on the factual information, some of which may be available from other sources, but also your sober, mature, well-considered advice, opinions, and evaluations. I realized while I was listening to that particular episode how glad I am that you've earned my trust from years of not only what you guys do, but how you do it. The other thing we're reaping now is the much-needed reassurance of your future podcasts to entertain, inform, stimulate, and provide a welcome retreat and sense of normalcy. As you know, lots of us have grown to consider you guys for virtual friends, and I'm sure all of us appreciate hearing from you regularly as a kind of social stimulation. On another subject, thanks especially for the two-parter on invertebrate emotions. Hope you can do a future episode on plant intelligence. My own personal view is that consciousness, in its definition as awareness or responsibility, is a fundamental aspect of the universe and is a nearly infinite continuum. So the question might be best put not as, do invertebrates have emotion, but where on the gradient of consciousness do they fall? Thanks a million, Jonathan."
Oh, well, that is far too kind, Jonathan. We appreciate hearing that we've earned your trust.
Yeah. I mean, certainly that's what we seek to do with the show in general. I will just remind everybody something about that COVID-19 episode that we also mentioned in that episode is that particular episode was very much set in the time of its recording, and it does not represent like the current best information about COVID-19.
Well, yeah, I mean, as we talked about in the episode, that's why we don't tend to do like developing news stories and stuff. But one example that comes to mind that was an extended discussion in the episode was about masks. Now, right. I remember at the time we were going along with all of the public health advice that we were reading, saying like, you know, normal people don't need to go out and buy up masks and all that kind of thing. And that seemed to be like basically all of the expert messaging. And then there's kind of a shift over time, right? Where clearly there were different values pulling intention in what kind of messaging was going out to people about whether they should wear masks or not. On one hand, there was like a shortage of masks and, you know, healthcare workers needed them and stuff like that. So there was kind of a discouraging of people to wear masks. And a lot of that discouragement came along with the opinions of many experts that like normal surgical masks are not very likely to reduce your likelihood of catching the disease through inhaling it. But there's been a shift over time, and I think a quite reasonable one, to saying, okay, if mask supplies are available, it actually is good to encourage people in general to wear masks, because especially it helps prevent the spread of COVID-19, if you are infected with the coronavirus. And that, you know, I think people have made some very good cases since then that even if you are unlikely to be infected, you've been practicing social distancing and all that kind of stuff, it's good for you to wear a mask when you go out, because first of all, you know, it's still possible that you're infected and you don't know it, and this could help prevent you from spreading it. But second, the more people wear masks, the more it reduces the stigma on masks, so that, you know, if somebody has a higher likelihood of being infected, they're not going to feel like, you know, like they're getting dagger eyes if they're out wearing a mask somewhere.
Yeah, yeah. It's and I, you know, it's been noted too that, like, you don't even necessarily need to fall back on some sort of like medical official mask, like just some sort of cloth covering for your face, right?
Yeah, better than nothing. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's a chance to spruce up your personal fashion. Like, if you had told me a year ago that, you know, a year in the future, my whole family would be decked out with fancy handkerchiefs around our necks when we go out, uh-huh. you know, and without adding the detail that we'd have to, you know, we'd be pulling them up onto our face frequently, I would have laughed. But here I am wearing a jaunty handkerchief from MeUndies, and I don't know, it's kind of fun in a way.
Wait, MeUndies, really?
Yes, yeah, MeUndies.
This is not a paid plug, by the way.
No, not a paid plug, though I am a subscriber, because they put out, you know, lots of fun designs for underwear, but they do other garments as well. And for a long time, they've been putting out these handkerchiefs. I don't know how many people were buying them previously, but it was suddenly like a really great option because it's like stretchy material. It's you know, has jazzy designs. You can customize the color. So yeah, so we ordered up three of those. We also have some face masks that kind of go around the ears that were custom made by a friend of ours who does a lot of crafting, and she's been making a whole lot of different masks for people, I think donating them to places as well.
That's great. Yeah, we got some homemade masks from crafty family members as well.
Oh, yeah. I should mention the one that my friend made actually has, it doesn't have Gamera on it, but it has, what was the flying creature? Gaos, something like that.
Oh, Gaos, yeah, the radioactive bats that emit rays.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. That's on the face mask. I should take a picture of that and share that with the discussion module on Facebook. That, for anybody who's not aware, that's where that's the Facebook group for Stuff to Blow Your Mind, where you can go and interact with other listeners, and then Joe and I sometimes pop in there as well.
Well, I would say the subject of Gamera and Gaos provides a great segue to our next message, and this comes from our listener, Sebastian.
Ah.
I assume that's Sebastian and not Sebastian based on spelling and the fact that this person is in Canada, but I'm not positive. It's the E-N kind.
Okay.
But I'm sorry if I said that wrong one way or another. Anyway, the message begins. Hey guys, I just took a look through your catalog and realized you've never done an episode on the topic of camp. As an old-fashioned gay man, camp is a huge part of the bread and butter of the media I prefer to consume. The topic itself may seem pretty literary, but it does have interesting implications. There are two broad definitions. Susan Sontag's failed seriousness, such as the Schwarzenegger Conan movies or the first Evil Dead, or John Waters' definition of camp being a celebration of poor taste. So not only John Waters himself, but also the entire Troma Studios catalog, as well as most exploitation genre movies. Some things are both, like American pro wrestling, and some things intend on being camp but end up being accidentally really good. My favorite example will always be Surf Nazis Must Die.
Ooh, I have not seen Surf Nazis Must Die. I'm vaguely familiar with it, but I haven't seen it. Is that a Troma?
I don't know. I've never seen that one either, though I have seen I remember seeing the box cover in the video store. Anyway, the email goes on. There's also some interesting research on the topic. So camp is often associated with working class intellectualism and minority populations, but it also has a strange link in that people who enjoy camp tend to also enjoy hard to watch high art cinema, like Tarkovsky or Jodorowsky. Some camp is both high art and in poor taste, like some select Lynch or the Canadian punk director Bruce LaBruce, whose movie Hustler White is on the very short list of movies censored by Bravo and Showcase. Think of characters like Richard Feynman when you think of a camp consumer. Erudite, but also somehow lowbrow, or at least that's the stereotype. Maybe the lads from Red Letter Media. There's also a place for camp in music, with irreverent bands like the Bonzo Dog Doodah Band or the Dead Milkmen, as well as literary camp, which is perhaps best captured in Harlequin romance or pulp fiction on the one hand, or in the bizarro fiction genre on the other. Seriously, it only takes an hour to read Shatner Quake. I don't know what that is. It sounds good.
I never read it, but I remember when it came out and talk of it was making the rounds. Yeah.
I'm sure if you guys took an interest, you could easily speak to it for an hour or more, as well as engage in the philosophy and sociology of it. Either way, keep up the good work. The Kama Muda episode is so far my favorite, with the Library of Babel being a close second. These two episodes actually did blow my mind. Take care, Sebastian from Canada.
Oh, wow. Well, it sounds like Sebastian is into a lot of the same things we are. That's for sure.
Yeah.
Because, you know, he maybe brings up like Jodorowsky, for example. I would argue that Jodorowsky is, there are plenty of moments where Jodorowsky is in poor taste. But it's also, you know, legitimately, there is a lot of, a lot to admire in there. There's a lot of, you know, very inspired, you know, fantastic artistic achievement. But it often doesn't seem like there's much of a filter there to keep one thing
right.
From going through.
Yeah. It's funny that he also mentions Tarkovsky, because I just recently watched my first Tarkovsky movie. I watched Stalker.
That's one I have not seen.
Oh, man, it's incredible. And I understand, like, some people are like, oh, my God, the Tarkovsky movies are too slow. I cannot deal with them. And it's true, the pacing is slow. But if you just allow yourself to commit to the slow pace, Stalker, at least, is an incredible work of art. I can hardly think of another movie I've seen that comes anywhere close to it. And in the kind of experience it creates, it's an otherworldly experience.
Nice. I need to give that one a viewing. That's been on my list for a while. I know they have it at Videodrome, but the main one, my first experience with his work was The Sacrifice. I think that was it. Or the Final Sacrifice, but yes, The Sacrifice. This was a 1986 film that he put out, and it is extremely slow. It has to do with a middle-aged intellectual who attempts to bargain with God to stop an impending nuclear holocaust. And I seem to recall it all takes place in this kind of, isolated island or coastal environment. So it was very, I remember thinking, I saw it in college on the big screen, and I remember thinking, this is beautiful, but also I wonder when it will ever end. Not that I necessarily, you know, have my eye on the clock. I'm just like, it's really still going on. And I don't know, I'd have no way of really knowing how close we are to the end here. Which is kind of a beautiful feeling that's lost in the way we watch cinema today, I think. You know, we generally know either what the runtime's going to be. We have it in our schedule. And certainly if we're watching it on the small screen, you know, we have a ticker there. You pause it and you can see exactly how much time you have remaining.
Yeah. Yeah. Obviously, movies today tend toward the tight and the formulaic. And so it's incredibly refreshing to watch. So Stalker is also, it's kind of a science fiction movie or very, very low technology science fiction. There's this vague idea that there's this zone where something has happened. It's never explicitly spelled out, but the Stalker is a character who leads people into this restricted zone where the laws of reality don't quite seem to hold.
Oh man, I need to see that then. I got to push that up on the list.
Yeah, it's gorgeous.
Let's see. Well, what else was brought up in this email from Sebastian? This certainly he brings up pro wrestling, American pro wrestling specifically. That's a pretty obvious example. He brings up Lynch. This is really, there might be something, especially if there, you know, there's been a fair amount written on it over time. Camp could be something worth looking into.
I agree. Yeah.
Real quick, having mentioned the Library of Babel episode that we recorded, brings to mind Borges. I have to say, just the other day, I was reading on my own, I was kind of reading about the Minotaur a bit, and I realized that I had never read Borges' short story, The House of Asterion, which is, like all of his works, super short. I think it's like 2.5 pages or something, mm-hmm. but it is the story of the Minotaur in the labyrinth from the Minotaur's point of view, and it is just beautiful. It's again, you know, he's one of those the master of the short story where you read something by Borges and you're like, why would anyone ever write anything longer than 2.5 pages? Because this is perfect. Oh, and by the way, I looked up Surf Nazis Must Die, and it is a trauma film.
Oh, of course.
1987. So really, that came out, the year after The Sacrifice. Okay.
Oh, all right.
Possible that maybe they were in the theater at the same time. I don't know. Maybe. Probably not.
It's a double feature.
All right. We'll be right back. Shout out to Astapro for sponsoring this episode and providing us with free samples.
Rob, as the local host with allergies here, they sent you some of their nasal spray to treat your allergies. What was your experience like?
Yeah, that's right. I always wrestle with the pollen a bit when it rolls in during the spring. So they sent me the little nasal spray. I tried out the product and yeah, it sure did help me get on top of my symptoms for the day. And it's so fast acting, it was already kicking in before I left the house.
Astapro is a first-of-its-kind nasal allergy spray. It's the fastest 24-hour over-the-counter allergy spray. It starts working in 30 minutes, while other allergy sprays take hours. Astapro is the first and only 24-hour steroid-free allergy spray. Astapro delivers full prescription-strength indoor and outdoor allergy relief from nasal congestion, runny and itchy nose, and sneezing.
Get fast-acting nasal allergy symptom relief with Astapro. Go to astaproallergy.com for a discount so you can get Astapro and go today. Astepro allergy.com. Astapro and go. Use this directed for relief of nasal congestion, runny nose, sneezing, and itchy nose due to allergies.
I'm Tamika D. Mallory.
And it's your boy, my son, the General.
And we are your hosts of TMI. New year, new name, new energy, but...
same old us.
And catch us every Wednesday on the Black Effect Network, breaking down social and civil rights issues, pop culture, and politics in hopes of pushing our culture forward to make the world a better place for generations to come. But that's not all. We will also have special guests to add their thoughts on the topics, as well as break down different political issues with local activists in their community. If you like to be informed and to expand your thoughts, listen to TMI on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
That's right.
When your child fights sleep, it can feel like a battle you'll never win. Imagine a bedtime routine you all look forward to, where you cuddle in and let the stress of the day melt away. Welcome to Sleep Tight Stories, a calming weekly podcast that brings bedtime stories, cuddles, and comfort to families worldwide. The stories are quirky, relatable, and spark wonder without overstimulation, so listeners can fall asleep and stay asleep. Each episode is narrated by me, Cheryl McLeod, a second grade teacher, and written by my husband, Clark, an eternal second grader at heart. Tune in tonight and bond over a story before drifting off to sleep. Make bedtime the sweetest part of your day. Sleep Tight Stories. Listen to Sleep Tight Stories on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Imagine you ask two people the same exact set of seven questions. I'm Minnie Driver, and this was the idea I set out to explore in my podcast, Mini Questions. This year, we bring a whole new group of guests to answer the same seven questions, including actress and star of the mega hit sitcom Friends, Courtney Cox.
You can't go around it, so you just go through it. This is a roadblock. It's going to catch you down the road. Go through it. Deal with it.
Comedian, writer, and star of the series Catastrophe, Rob Delaney.
I shouldn't feel guilty about my son's death. He died of a brain tumor. It's part of what happens when your kid dies. Intellectually, you'll understand that it's not your fault, but you'll still feel guilty.
Alt-rock icon, Liz Phair.
That personal disaster wrote Guyville. So everything comes out of a dead end.
And many, many more. Join me on season 3 of Mini Questions on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Seven questions, limitless answers.
All right, we're back.
Okay, so this next email comes to us from Matthew. So Matthew had a bunch of great stuff to say. A big part of his email was focused on response to our Hobbit biology episode. He had this interesting Hobbit self-domestication hypothesis, but it was a long email, so I apologize, Matthew. In the interest of time, I'm skipping to the second half of the email where he shares ideas in response to several different episodes. And so one of them is also about Hobbit biology. Remember, a lot of what we talked about in the Hobbit biology episode was about like Hobbit metabolism and caloric requirements. You know, that they've got to eat so much. So Matthew says, what if the incredibly high caloric requirements of hobbits were due to some mutation which reduced their ability to absorb or utilize a particular nutrient like an essential amino acid? In such case, they would have to eat much more of foods rich in this nutrient. It probably wouldn't go without general increase in caloric intake, which in turn would prime selection for individuals with faster metabolism, because others would suffer greatly from obesity and other consequences of overeating, and thus have their fitness substantially reduced. This could happen in a food-abundant area, such as the Shire, and if the initial population would be small enough to allow the founder effect. Also, other more positive effects of this mutation would make its survival in the gene pool more likely. By the way, this was the explanation for why Peter Watts vampires must eat humans. This is Peter Watts vampires from the book Blindsight. Matthew says, they cannot synthesize Y-protocadherine, a vital peptide, which is unique to hominins. So the idea, yeah, there in the story was that these plausibly biological vampires have to eat humans because they need this nutrient that basically only exists in apes like us.
All right. So kind of a Peter Wattsian read on The Hobbit. Okay.
Right. Then a second one. This one is related to the idea of plants developing intelligence. This has come up in other episodes. Like, could you imagine other kingdoms of life, not animals, but maybe plants or fungi or whatever, ever over billions of years of evolution developing intelligence of their own? Matthew mentioned somebody named Isaac Arthur. He says, if you don't know this guy, I highly recommend his YouTube channel. He mentioned in one of his episodes that it would be more plausible for fungi to develop intelligence than plants, since they do not rely on a regular and perpetual source of energy, such as sunlight. If their source of energy gets depleted, this may motivate them to search for another one, which would require some degree of mobility and perhaps, in a more complex and unpredictable environment, some kind of higher intelligence. I like this idea.
All right. Well, that's a pretty cool take, I'll admit.
Third, now this one is in response to our episode of invention where we talked about the invention of words and how new words are formed. One of the things we talked about was back formation and false etymologies. Matthew singles out the word algorithm as an interesting example of a word invented by back formation. I looked this up and this is extremely interesting. So apparently, the word algorithm comes to English through several steps, beginning with the medieval Latin algorismus, which is actually a botched transliteration of a proper name. There was a medieval Persian polymath named Muhammad ibn Musa al-Khwarizmi, and when his works on mathematics were translated into Latin, the name al-Khwarizmi got changed into algorismus, which became algorithm over time. So this is like a lost reference to an actual person's name.
Very fascinating.
And then finally, Matthew brings up the subject of invertebrate emotions, which we did a two-parter about. And he says, when you did it, I couldn't believe you didn't mention this. And he makes reference to an article in The Guardian where there's a study where basically they were giving MDMA to octopuses. So Matthew says, when given MDMA, octopuses act similarly to human users of MDMA, whose behavior under its influence we would interpret as signs of kindness, greater openness to fellow specimens, and desire for closure and intimacy. And I looked this up, and apparently when you give octopuses MDMA, a lot of their conspecific aggressiveness decreases or vanishes. Normally, octopuses are not very social and they're not very friendly to each other. When one octopus comes on the other, they often, you know, fight or try to eat each other or something. When you give octopuses MDMA, apparently they're much more likely to approach peacefully and sort of like extend arms toward one another.
Interesting. I mean, Yeah, because octopuses are generally solitary creatures. This brings to mind like the possibility, like what if you had something like the monolith in 2001: A Space Odyssey, but instead of like imbuing surrounding organisms with the knowledge of tool use, what if it had kind of an MDMA effect on them and
right.
and inspired them to be more supportive and and accepting of each other? I wonder what the long term effects would be for a species.
Yeah, instead of giving hominins violent mechanical ingenuity, it gives octopuses love. I bring you love.
Or maybe they would have all these, if they would just have been eaten by, what were they, leopards or I can't remember, jaguars in the movie?
Oh, yeah. I think there's a leopard. Yeah.
Yeah. The leopard would have just eaten all of them, maybe. It wouldn't have worked. Maybe that was the first monolith that they sent down.
Anyway, Matthew finishes by saying, thank you for all your work and sorry for my English. I'm sure I've made at least a few mistakes. No, Matthew, your English is great.
Yeah, far better than my Polish.
Right. I've been listening to Stuff to Blow Your Mind and more recently Invention for almost 2 years and dug through a lot of episodes to 2015 or thereabouts. Podcasts on my subscribed list come and go, but since I discovered you, there probably wasn't a single week when your voice didn't play in my earbuds. Best regards, Matthew from Poland. Oh, well, that was so sweet. What a great email, Matthew.
Yeah, that was good. Lots of cool ideas in there. All right, here's another bit of listener mail. This one comes to us from Lauren, and it's another Hobbit email. Hi, Robert and Joe. Love the podcast, and it's keeping me interested and motivated to learn new things during these strange times. A quick note about dinner versus supper in your Biology of the Hobbit episode, since you both said you weren't sure of the difference. It's a very modern thing to use these terms interchangeably, but anyone who's read a lot of books set in Regency England, as I have, will know that 1 ate dinner, probably around 7 p.m., before 1 attended a ball or evening's entertainment, and 1 ate supper a few hours later during the ball to keep up your energy for dancing, or after coming home from the theater. Very tonish use of these words and very British. So while the Hobbits don't seem very aristocratic, they do seem very British. And it's probably why Tolkien had them eating both dinner and supper along with their other meals. Thanks for all you do, Lauren.
Well, wait, were the Hobbits having to go out dancing eat supper to keep their energy up? I don't remember a lot of dancing.
Well, they had festivals and celebrations,
I guess so.
And certainly, especially if you're Bilbo, you might have to entertain a lot of out-of-town guests for an extended period of time.
That's true. Well, thank you, Lauren. I appreciate that clarification. And then on a very similar subject, we got this next message from Samantha. Samantha says, hi, guys. In your recent Biology of the Hobbit episode, you mused on what the difference was between dinner and supper in regards to the different meals enjoyed by hobbits. While I can't speak to the hobbit lifestyle, I am in a relationship with a man who used to power lift. And I can tell you that I've decided that the difference is that dinner is the meal he eats with me and supper is the meal afterward that he eats in bed before going to sleep. It's not so much a midnight snack as a midnight entree. Anyway, oh, wow. Thanks for the amazing work you guys do, and thanks for the extra episodes lately, Sam.
Well, what I love about this is just that it brings to mind the possibility of powerlifter hobbits, and it's pretty great.
Uh-huh. What do hobbit strongmen look like? I want to see that.
I mean, I can kind of... Aren't we told... was it the Tooks that were more adventurous? Maybe they were kind of powerlifters in their own way.
Oh, maybe.
All right, here's another one. This one comes to us from Anna. Hi, Robert and Joe. I just finished listening to your episode on hobbits. This reminded me of how my dad used to have a cat called Frodo. The cat used to go on long journeys in the car with him. This got me thinking how cats have many of the same characteristics as hobbits. And she lists them for us. They like their home comforts. True. They can be very adventurous when they want to be. They're very light on foot. They are good at hiding and stealing things. They would prefer to find a few people they like and only hang around them. They have hair on their feet. They are small. They like fish. They also really enjoy eating. I wonder if anyone else has noticed these similarities, Anna.
I find no fault in this.
No, this sounds about right. As a cat owner, I can say my cat is often like a hobbit, except when she is hunting my feet for sport in the house, in which case I would say she's more like a goblin. This, maybe she's more like Sméagol or Gollum in this respect. So she is like a hobbit, but like a hobbit whose soul has been tarnished and perverted by the power of the ring over time.
She thinks your feet are nasty, tricksy humans is.
Yeah, I think the ring in this situation would be human domestication, or, you know, or certainly being asked to live inside a house is kind of the ring here, because that can only corrupt and alter their psychology. Our cat is an indoor cat, but clearly she wants to go outside, and her behavior is such that it ultimately, you know, evolutionarily speaking, it belongs outside. But we've made this pact, right, that we're going to keep her inside, because she also does not belong in the immediate vicinity. She doesn't belong out there eating birds and whatnot. You know, and likewise, she would end up getting in fights with the local ferals. She'd be run off, or she'd be hit by a car. Like, there's, you know, all these other considerations. But clearly, we're dealing with a very artificial environment, artificial situation that has been brought on by humans spreading themselves and their varmints around the world.
And nine rings to the kings of cats who desire power above all else.
But to some, I know some people are going to want to remind us, cats are only semi-domesticated. And again, I do agree with that. They're clearly not on the same level as the dog in being, you know, a part of our community.
No knock on them, of course.
Now, who would the dogs be in Middle Earth?
Oh, I don't know. Who's loyal and true? The only brew for the brave and true.
Maybe they would be the dwarves, you know?
No, maybe. Yeah. I think, yeah, it could be dwarves.
Sometimes maybe they dig too deep.
Dogs
bring up something that shouldn't be brought up to the surface.
Dogs are all Tom Bombadil. They're just an entire species of Bombadils. All right, so here's one that I didn't know if we'd hear anything back on. In our episode about the Bone Palace, where we talked about Stone Age huts made out of mammoth bones, we ended up talking about a house in Wyoming, I believe, that is made out of, or purported at least to be made out of, dinosaur bones or dinosaur fossils. And we ended up saying, like, hey, do we have any listeners in Wyoming? I know it is a sparsely populated place, but we heard from a couple. I was delighted. So first of all, we heard from Louise, who said, hi, Robert and Joe. First of all, love the podcast. I heard the Wyoming mention in the Bone Palace episode. I thought it was pretty funny. As a matter of fact, I listened to you guys from Casper, Wyoming, and thought I might as well send an email about it. I hope I'm not the only one listening from over here, but you never know. Keep up the good work. The podcast is awesome. Louise. And then we also heard from Landon, who said Landon listens from Cheyenne, Wyoming, and says if we ever do a show in Wyoming, that that Landon will bring friends. So we'll keep it posted.
All right. Good to know. All right. Here we have a listener mail from Brittany about our episodes on Deja Vu. Hey guys, I just finished listening to your second episode on Deja Vu, which I found very interesting. You ask at one point for listener experience with Deja Paradox, feeling like you have experienced a paradox before. As you described it, I recognized it as a feeling I sometimes experience during religious exercises such as prayer. When I am contemplating the paradoxes inherent in my faith, on rare occasions I do get a flash of something very much like Deja Vu. The paradox I am meditating on seems to take on a new depth and become somehow more essentially contradictory, more paradoxical, while simultaneously feeling powerfully familiar and deeply fundamentally necessary to reality. As it is, I have always known this paradox to be real, but I am usually blind to it, and it is only clear in little flashes like these. Yet at the same time, I am experiencing their depth in a way I know is entirely new. Obviously, I am familiar with the surface paradox I am contemplating in these times, so perhaps this isn't a perfect fit, but the paradox I seem to uncover is always new to me and entirely beyond my ability to describe, and that is when I get a deja vu-like experience. I had never thought about it in those terms before, but the subjective experience is remarkably similar to my experience with deja vu. I think this has happened maybe three times in my life, but it's such a powerful experience, even with how short it is, that I remember each one. Anyway, now that I wrote all of that out, I'm questioning whether this is truly deja paradox or not. But maybe you can decide if you think it counts. Thanks for all the work you put into the show. I truly love exploring the weird and cool things of the universe with you both. Brittany.
Oh, thanks, Brittany. Yeah, I found that really interesting because it got me thinking about what is supposed to be happening in the religious practices that encourage you to contemplate a paradox. I don't know how widespread this is, like if there's something like this in almost every religion. The main examples I can think of are in like Zen Buddhism, which encourages the contemplation of paradoxes, and in Christianity, you know, one tradition of Christianity has a kind of mystical flavor that encourages you to think about the apparent paradox of the Trinity, you know, that there can be one being in three, how is that possible, and so forth. But I'm sure there are things like this in other religions too.
Yeah, and as for whether this counts as deja paradox, deja vu, I don't know. I'm a kind of the mind that you know deja vu when you feel it. Like it's undeniable. Mm-hmm. So if one is inclined to interpret what is happening as deja vu, then it is probably deja vu or some related experience. You know, like I would lean into the individual's experience of the thing.
Yeah, deja vu is in the sensation, not in any kind of like externally verifiable quality. So yeah, it's if it feels like deja vu, it's deja vu. All right, well, I think we need to take another break, but then we will be right back to round this out with a couple more emails.
I'm Tamika D. Mallory.
And it's your boy, my son, the General.
And we are your hosts of TMI. New year, new name, new energy, but
same old. Oh, yeah.
And catch us every Wednesday on the Black Effect Network, breaking down social and civil rights issues, pop culture, and politics in hopes of pushing our culture forward to make the world a better place for generations to come. But that's not all. We will also have special guests to add their thoughts on the topics, as well as break down different political issues with local activists in their community. If you like to be informed and to expand your thoughts, listen to TMI on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
That's right.
Imagine you ask two people the same exact set of seven questions. I'm Minnie Driver, and this was the idea I set out to explore in my podcast, Mini Questions. This year, we bring a whole new group of guests to answer the same seven questions, including actress and star of the mega hit sitcom Friends, Courteney Cox.
You can't go around it, so you just go through it. This is a roadblock. It's going to catch you down the road. Go through it. Deal with it.
Comedian, writer, and star of the series Catastrophe, Rob Delaney.
I shouldn't feel guilty about my son's death. He died of a brain tumor. It's part of what happens when your kid dies. Intellectually, you'll understand that it's not your fault, but you'll still feel guilty.
Alt-rock icon, Liz Phair.
That personal disaster wrote Guyville. So everything comes out of a dead end.
And many, many more. Join me on season 3 of Mini Questions on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Seven questions, limitless answers.
Something that makes me crazy is when people say, well, I had this career before, but it was a waste. And that's where the perspective shift comes, that it's not a waste, that everything you've done has built you to where you are now. This is She Pivots, the podcast where we explore the inspiring pivots women have made and dig deeper into the personal reasons behind them. Join me, Emily Tisch Sussman, every Wednesday on She Pivots as I sit down with inspiring women like Misty Copeland, Brooke Shields, Vanessa Hudgens, and so many more. We dive into how these women made their pivot and their mindset shifts that happened as a result. It's a podcast about women, their stories, and how their pivot became their success. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Parents, ready to discover a new educational and interactive podcast for kids? Join Stories for Kids by Lingo Kids, where episodes are packed with fun activities. Right, Elliot?
Oh, Oh, yes! We learned how to recycle at the beach.
That was great fun. Callie, what do you say?
It was. And that time when we did the science experiment and Billy made Raisin's dance.
That is so cool, Billy.
He did. Not to mention when a certain Elliot took up swimming classes with Lisa.
That was me!
Bet you can't catch me.
I'm going to catch you.
All this fun and more in our Stories for Kids. Lingo Kids Stories for Kids is now available on StoryButton, the kid-friendly device for screenless podcast listening. Listen to Stories for Kids on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
All right, we're back.
Okay, so we got a bunch of great mail about our episodes on Medusa. This first message comes from Jim in New Jersey, who's a longtime correspondent. Jim says, Robert and Joe, your painted eyes comment to protect cattle from lions in Medusa 2 reminded me of this story about eyes watching those with an honor system for office refreshments. And he links to a piece by Freakonomics that's about a study on whether, you know, you can basically use scarecrows to affect honorable or honest behavior of humans in an office setting. So to read a quote that he provides, quote, Melissa Bateson and colleagues at Newcastle University in the UK put up new price lists each week in their psychology department coffee room. Prices were unchanged, but each week there was a photocopied picture at the top of the list measuring 15 by 3 centimeters of either flowers or the eyes of real faces. The faces varied, but the eyes always looked directly at the observer. In weeks with eyes on the list, staff paid 2.76 times as much for their drinks as in weeks with flowers. Quote, frankly, we were staggered by the size of the effect, Gilbert Roberts, one of the researchers, told New Scientist. So yeah, it looks like here you just put up a picture of eyes staring at somebody. Maybe, I don't know if a Gorgonion image would work, but any kind of like image of eyes looking right at you, this may have a psychological effect that discourages sneaky or stingy or dishonest behavior.
All right, this one comes to us from Carolina. Carolina writes, in the Head of the Medusa Part 2, you discuss how monster faces in ancient art are depicted looking back at the observer. It made me think of the Tao Ti, a monstrous creature that frequently is depicted on Shang Dynasty ceremonial bronze vessels, which looks kind of like a tiger with a bull's horns. The Tao Ti image was too common to have been meaningless, but there are no extant records from the Shang Dynasty indicating what it signifies. After listening to the episode, it crossed my mind that the Tao Ti images might have been apotropaic. It was a fascinating episode and left me with a lot to think about. Thank you. Best regards, Carolina.
I looked up the Tao Ti image, and it is very interesting. It's like a, it almost in some ways looks kind of like ancient Mesoamerican art with the some of the types of the way the lines come together to form the facial structure of the monster. I really liked it.
Yeah, this is pretty cool. I don't think I was familiar with this this particular motif, but it's quite interesting.
Apparently, this is also the name they give to the monsters in that Great Wall movie. I never saw the movie, but I remember that thing. It has like Matt Damon in it or something, where there's like monsters attacking the Great Wall, and all these warriors have to fight them off. The monsters are like these big, you know, lizard, dog, frog type things, and I think they're supposed to be Tao Ti.
Yeah, I remember seeing the trailer for it. I'm really surprised I didn't see that one on an airplane. That looks like a good airplane viewing. Mm-hmm.
Okay, one more message about Medusa. This comes from Dan. Dan says, hello again, Robert and Joe. I just finished listening to part one of your Medusa episode. I greatly enjoyed it and look forward to part two. I'm writing to you regarding movie depictions of Medusa. From listening to the podcast and watching your trailer talk videos on YouTube, whoa, that's a blast from the past.
Oh, yeah, that is.
I know you both love Hammer horror, so I was wondering if you're familiar with The Gorgon, a movie from 1964 starring Peter Cushing, the man with cheekbones that could cut diamonds, and Christopher Lee. I think that may be a reference to something we said about him in the past.
It definitely is. I think it was possibly Uncanny Valley, where we were talking specifically about Peter Cushing as resurrected in the Star Wars movie Rogue One.
That's it. Yeah. Yeah.
It's on my mind because I've just watched Rogue One again the other day as part of the family viewing of all the Star Wars movies.
Dan, you're going deep in the Stuff to Blow Your Mind lore. This is crazy. So Dan goes on, I've never seen the film, talking about The Gorgon from 1964, but I remember reading about it a long time ago in Jeff Rovin's Encyclopedia of Monsters. I've included a link to the trailer below. I hope you are safe and doing well under these current circumstances. May Crom watch over and protect both of your families, Dan. Oh, well, that's so sweet, Dan. And I went and I watched this trailer. Thank you so much for sharing. I did not know about this movie, and now I'm going to watch it because not only is it Hammer horror with a Gorgon in it, but also Christopher Lee is so scruffy looking in this movie. He's got this bushy mustache and bushy hair. He looks extremely unkempt for Christopher Lee.
Yeah, like he looks more unkempt in this film than he does when he's playing the mummy or Frankenstein, which is strange. he looks pretty rough in this one. I have never seen it, but after this email came in, I did watch the trailer, and it looks like a lot of fun. I mean, all the Hammer horror films look like a lot of fun. And I guess I'd probably seen the trailer before and forgotten about it because I have this beloved disc. I love compilations of trailers, and I have a Hammer horror films comp disc, an official one from years back, and I still occasionally put that on, and I'll just let the beautiful trailers roll over me.
I'm gonna say maybe I'm gonna watch The Gorgon tonight.
Yeah, it looks fun. I scanned the other people involved, and there's no one else on the IMDb that I'm especially familiar with, but you know, those films tended to be filled with a lot of very talented actors, even if you don't know who they are.
It was directed by Terrence Fisher. I was just looking this up here. Yes, Terrence Fisher directed the Hammer version of The Mummy that has Christopher Lee as the mummy and also has Peter Cushing in it as the kind of like the bony-faced hero. And I've got a copy of the Belgian version of the poster for this movie on the wall in my office for The Mummy, where it's not called The Mummy, it's called Les Malédictions de Pharaon.
Yeah, he also Terrence Fisher directed a bunch of Hammer horror films. He also directed Frankenstein and the Monster from Hell from 1974, which has one of my favorite monster designs from any of these because it looks like a man ape that had the top of its head sewn back on, and the monster was played by David Prowse, Darth Vader himself.
Oh, wow.
And of course, Peter Cushing was in it as Baron Frankenstein. So you had, wonderful Star Wars energy going on in that film as well. In this, of course, we're pitching our next podcast, which will be Robert and Joe just talk about Hammer horror movies for a 30-minute block of time.
Let's do it. Would anybody listen? I don't know. If we had an audience for that, I would absolutely do a Hammer horror podcast.
Oh yeah, there's so many. There's plenty to talk about. So yeah, let the letter writing campaign begin. All right, here's another one. This one comes to us from Tyler. Tyler says, "Hey guys, just wanted to reach out and say, hey, I'm listening to your episode on cars and driving where you talked about the knowledge that taxi drivers of yesteryear, specifically in London, had to have and how that has been shown to generate more gray matter in the brain. Not sure if you've considered it, but I think bicycle messengers could be a more current example of this. I worked as a bicycle messenger for 3 years in the city. Most messengers ride brakeless bicycles designed to be raced on velodromes. It seems crazy, but they are simple machines that are extremely durable and reliable. They give the user a lot of control and feedback. Messengers ride in dense and unpredictable urban traffic, and like taxi drivers, have varying destinations around the city throughout the day. They're often in this setting for 8 or more hours a day. On top of that, their brakeless bikes can't stop very fast. As a result, they end up developing incredible predictive and spatial awareness skills. It gets to the point that they can fairly accurately predict traffic aberrations and develop this sort of third eye where they know what's going to happen 3 seconds into the future. I would imagine that researchers would find similar growth of gray matter in these subjects. Just thought I'd share. Cheers, T.
That's interesting and scary. I admit I know how to ride a bike, but I have not done a lot of bicycle riding as an adult. And the idea of like cutting around on a brakeless bike in city traffic is just it fills me with dread.
Yeah. I'm kind of in the same boat. I haven't done a lot of bicycle riding, and what I have done as an adult has been has not been in a purely urban setting. Like it's not been on the streets of Atlanta or anything. And I have to say that though, I certainly feel this desire, especially now. Like maybe I need to get a bike. Maybe now is the time to get a bike. And it may be, but on the other hand, I am a little trepidatious about getting out there on the streets, even in their current form.
Robert, you want to finish up with these emails about pointing?
Yeah, let's get into pointing. We had a wonderful two-parter on that. So this one comes to us from Sophia. Hi, just listened to your two-parter on pointing. Very intriguing stuff. What came to my mind regarding pointing in non-human animals and curious animal communication in general was the way that bees communicate in a hive using something called a waggle dance to tell each other where food, water can be found. With these movements, they can communicate the direction and distance to the source with amazingly high precision. Thought you might find it interesting. Love your show. Keep up the great work. Best regards, Sophia.
Yeah, I don't know how I didn't think of this in the episode. Clearly, this is an example of pointing, right? It indicates directionality and it directs the attention of other animals to the target.
Yeah, I don't know why I didn't think of this either. I was even fishing around a little bit for information about pointing in eusocial insects. And here we have an example.
This next message comes from Gilead. Gilead says, "Hi, Joe and Robert. First, I'd like to thank you for the wonderful podcast you put out every week. It's a great way for me to pass my commute and experience new stuff with your really neat style of presenting. Thank you. Two points I thought you might find interesting in connection to your latest episode on pointing. First, the morning after I listened to your podcast, I went to the supermarket for my weekly purchase of goods, and since they rearranged it, I found it difficult to find the stuff I usually buy. I stopped by a worker to ask her where rice was, and she pointed out the direction. I noticed that she was turning her wrist at 90 degrees to the right, so the back of her hand was facing right instead of up. It immediately clicked with all that you talked about. As I was walking in the direction she indicated, looking around to find the rice, I understood that she was trying to indicate that the rice was hidden behind a corner to the left. It was pretty neat to see what you were talking about in real life action." Right. So I think what they're saying here is that the pointing of the hand turned so that it was oriented so the fingertip could have reached around to touch the rice. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But anyway, going on with the email, I don't think she was even aware that she did that, nor am I sure that I would have picked up on it if I hadn't listened to your podcast. Second, growing up in Israel in the 80s, there was only one public channel on TV. At the end of each day, before sounding the national anthem and ending the transmission, yes, that's the way it was back then, they would read one verse from the Bible using the traditional yod. Remember, we brought that up in the episode. It was like a pointing device that has sometimes a little hand shape at the end of it that you can scan along on the Torah with or scan along on the text. Gilead continues, "So I thought it might be interesting for you to see how that actually looked, since it was part of the TV experience of every kid at that time. Here's a link you can watch." I did watch the link, and it looks very interesting. I also like the way that as the reader is moving along the text with the yod and reading out loud, the camera is also slowly zooming out. I don't know exactly. It creates this very weird feeling of kind of like power and revelation.
Yes, I watched this as well. It's wonderful. I would love to share it with everyone, but the title of the YouTube is in Hebrew, and I'm not sure how to share that. But it's really interesting. I like it a lot.
Yeah. Anyway, Gilead finishes. Thanks again, and keep up the great work.
All right, this one comes to us from Matt. Good day, Robert and Joe. I've written to you before in response to an episode of Invention, though not yet for Stuff to Blow Your Mind. Thought I would send a note regarding your most recent episode on pointing, part two. Specifically, you briefly discussed plant communication and whether there is any directional element to it. I farm with my family in southwestern Ontario, but my day gig is working as a freelance agriculture and science writer. The subject of plant communication, specifically crop responses and communication in response to weeds, is a subject I've covered a number of times. It's not exactly the same subject as you both discussed, but it is related. University of Guelph research back in the 1980s showed the presence of weeds early in the growing season caused clearly quantifiable drops in crop yields, several bushels per day for corn, in fact, which is quite alarming for farmers. But the mechanism by which this happens has not been well understood until recently. Now we know that these yield drops are a direct result of crops detecting and communicating the presence of weeds even before seedlings emerge from the soil. That detection cues stress-induced adaptive responses, which have a rapid and irreversible negative effect on yield. This is why early season weed control is so vital for the farm business. The detection process itself works as corn and soybeans register light, reflected from the far red end of the spectrum by weeds. Crop seedlings can even perform this detection and responsive action before emerging from the ground, permanently altering their own morphology. The younger the plant, the more susceptible it is. And then he also shares the article that he's referencing. Anyway, I hope you find the subject interesting as I did. And one last thing, I would also like to reiterate how thankful I am to have such excellent high-quality audio content to consume during these strange days. Yes, that's a H.P. Lovecraft reference. When that stress beastie gets its teeth in, sometimes it's the apparent conversations with virtual friends that make all the difference. Thanks very much for your work. Stay healthy and remember to have a good time as well. Matt.
Thanks, Matt. We weren't sure what the H.P. Lovecraft reference there. Is it the phrase "strange days"?
I don't know. I mean, certainly there's some plant shenanigans in at least one H.P. Lovecraft story. But this may be a way homer. Of course, I'm always home now, so it's not not really. I guess my way to another room. It'll suddenly occur to me what he's referencing, and we'll have to bring it up on another episode.
All right, this next message comes to us from Ilva, and this will be the last one. So Ilva says, "Hello! While I've been an avid listener for 9 years now, I've never quite felt like emailing you before. I just found today's episode on pointing a lot of fun, partly because I always love stuff on communication because I'm autistic, and finer social skills often pass me by. I'm suddenly made aware of all the times I've made a faux pas and pointed at myself and other people with an extended finger. Oops." Well, I'd say, you know, depending on the context, it might not have been a faux pas. It's just like, I don't know, it varies, right?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, it's good. Situation is key.
Yeah. But Ilva continues, and partly because of the non-human animals part. "I have a medical alert and service dog. He's been with me for 9 years, and he's smart. Suddenly, I realized how much of our communication happens by me pointing at things. I can point with my hand, finger, an object like a shoehorn, or with my foot. Eyeline is not necessary because I wear sunglasses outside and it works great without him knowing my line of sight. It's a huge part of our everyday life. Bring me that thing, go over there, put that thing there, etc. While he knows a lot of words and commands, pointing is really the only way to differentiate between different pairs of shoes or give him directions. I cannot recall consciously teaching him this, but it's never been a problem for him. He also does some sort of pointing on his own. He indicates things I should pay attention to by scratching his paw on the floor in front of it, like dropped medication he's not allowed to touch, or when he just wants me to give him something, or his toy is stuck under the sofa, or I need to refill the water bowl and such. My other dog was picked up as an adult from the street 4 years ago, and while he's not a herding dog like my service dog, he's probably of normal dog intelligence, and pointing just goes over his head. With him, I've tried to train it, but he gets what I mean maybe 25% of the time, and that's a lot better than when I first got him home. Possibly it's a skill acquired in puppyhood while interacting with humans, if it's not inherent. This episode was very interesting, and I hope you can talk more to an elephant/dolphin expert. I'm sending you a picture of the dog in question, Atlas, and much appreciation from me here in Sweden, Ilva." And what an adorable dog in this picture.
It's a pretty good dog. And it's looking up. I thought I'd heard that dogs couldn't do that. But
Yeah, I don't know. You should check your sources on that. Well, this has been a great mailbag. Thank you, everyone, so much for getting in touch. This has been really great. And as we always say, you know, if your message wasn't featured, please don't take it personally. We get too much to read on the show, but we really do appreciate all the correspondence we get.
Yeah, I mean, and also lots of cool stuff comes up on the discussion module, the Stuff to Blow Your Mind Facebook group. Like somebody shared a video of someone pointing with both fingers on a basketball court.
Oh, yeah. And it was incredibly aggressive was what they were pointing out was that, well, you know, we talked about the idea of pointing with both hands seemingly as a way to blunt the taboo of pointing with a particular hand or pointing with an index finger. But in this case, is the pointing with both hands happened after like somebody got dunked on, and then the mm-hmm. guy who dunked on the other guy pointed at him with both hands as he's lying on the floor. And it was like, it was the most savage owning I've ever seen.
All right. So yeah, so probably don't try that in real life unless you're really going for a savage presentation like that. All right. Well, in the meantime, if you want to check out other episodes of Stuff to Blow Your Mind, you know where to find them. It's wherever you get your podcast. And wherever that happens to be, just make sure that you rate, that you review, and that you subscribe. Those are the three things that you can do that really help out the show. Also, in general, if you enjoy the show, you know, share it with other people. Tell them about it. If there's an episode that, you know, maybe it's episode by episode. You know, we cover a lot of ground. Not every episode of the show is going to appeal to everybody. But, you know, occasionally you're going to come across one where you're like, you know, I bet Uncle Steve would dig this episode of Stuff to Blow Your Mind. I'm going to send it to him.
That's right. Get us into Steve's ears. That's your job this week.
Yeah, we're going after that Steve demographic.
Anyway, huge thanks, as always, to our excellent audio producer, Seth Nicholas Johnson. If you would like to get in touch with us with feedback on this episode or any other, to suggest a topic for the future, or just to say hello, you can email us at contact@stufftoblowyourmind.com.
Stuff to Blow Your Mind is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan. For data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
Welcome to Season 9 of Next Question with me, Katie Couric. I've got some big news to share with you in our season premiere featuring the one and only Kris Jenner.
Oh my gosh, congratulations. That is very, very exciting.
And that's just the beginning. We'll also be joined by podcast host Jay Shetty, Hillary Clinton, Renee Fleming, Liz Cheney, and many more. So come on in, take a break from the incessant negativity for a weekly dose of fascinating conversations. Some of them, I promise, will actually put you in a good mood. Listen to Next Question with me, Katie Couric, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Tamika D. Mallory.
And it's your boy, my son, the General.
And we are your hosts of TMI. And catch us every Wednesday on the Black Effect Network, breaking down social and civil rights issues, pop culture, and politics, in hopes of pushing our culture forward to make the world a better place for generations to come. Listen to TMI on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
That's right.
Oh, hi, I'm Rachel Zoe, and my podcast, Climbing in Heels, is back and better than ever. You might know me from the Rachel Zoe Project, or perhaps from my work as a celebrity stylist. And guess what? I'm still just as obsessed with all things fashion, beauty, and business. Climbing in Heels is all about celebrating the stories of extraordinary women, and this season is here to bring you a weekly dose of glamour, inspiration, and fun. Listen to Climbing in Heels every Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.